The theme tonight is science and faith. Are there enemies or allies? And I'm going to be focusing this talk predominantly on my discipline of astronomy. And it's astronomy where we get the most compelling evidences for the God of the Bible. And that's because astronomy is unique amongst the sciences in that we have direct access to past events. Now, I always tell my wife, because I'm an astronomer, I can't be held accountable for the present because all of our data comes from the past. When we look at a star, we have to wait for light to travel from that star to reach our telescope. But today, we have telescopes so powerful, we can look so far away that we're looking back in time to actually witnessing the creation of the universe. Now, people say, that sounds like an exaggeration. How close can your imaging power get you to the moment of the cosmic creation event? The answer is, we can get within 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. That's so close we can get. And it's our capacity to directly witness the creation of the universe that we get some of our most compelling evidences for the God of the Bible. That's kind of a quick summary of what I'm going to be speaking about this evening. Now, I told you earlier that I began my studies in astronomy when I was 7 years of age. The first book I read on cosmology was by Sir Fred Hoyle, Nature of the Universe. Our public school had just got his book. I was the first one in the school to read it, Nature of the Universe. And when you read that book, he's got several chapters where he pours out anger and vehemence against the Christian faith. He hated the Christian faith in the Bible. But at one point in the book, and page 109, he says this about the Bible. There's a good deal of cosmology in the Bible. It is a remarkable conception. Now, I didn't become a Christian until I was 19. My parents weren't Christians. I didn't know any Christians at all. In fact, I didn't really get to know a Christian until I arrived at the Caltech campus. Canada, like here, there are not that many Christians per capita. And unlike here in Canada, the Christians isolate themselves. And so outside of Vancouver, where I was raised, there was a community that was about 85% Christian. But where I was raised, it was way, way below 1%. So I didn't really get to meet Christians until I arrived at Caltech. There is a good deal of cosmology in the Bible. And when I reached age 16 and realized the universe had a beginning, and at 17 began to look at the world's holy books to see what it said about this beginner of the universe, I realized what Fred said when I was 7 years of age was true. Compared to all the other holy books, the Bible says more than 10 times as much about the origin and history of the universe. In fact, the Bible says more than 10 times as much as all the rest of the world's holy books combined. And what I'm going to review for you are the four main themes that the Bible addresses about the universe. It basically talks about four different features of the universe. The Bible says a lot more, but these are the ones it repeatedly addresses. Namely, that the universe comes out of a singularity beginning. Now, that's a technical term that we physicists use, basically meaning that the universe is traceable back to an actual beginning of space, time, matter, and energy. And how the universe expands from that space-time beginning expands under laws of physics that never change throughout the history of the universe, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. Now, I'm going to show you very quickly where the Bible makes these statements and then what kind of evidence we have from astronomy that these biblical statements are true. But one thing I'll share with you, there is no other holy book that makes these statements about the universe. These statements in ancient literature are unique to the Bible. Most of you are probably familiar about the Bible statements about the beginning. I find that no matter where I travel in the world, everybody has heard of the first sentence of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. They may not realize that the phrase, the heavens and the earth, means the entire universe of matter, energy, space, and time. or the word create means to bring into existence something brand new that never existed before. But as you can see, there are many other biblical texts that talk about the beginning of the universe. Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. And compared to all the other holy books, religions of the world, the Bible is unique in speaking about a space-time beginning. In the other religions, it speaks about God, gods, or cosmic forces creating within space and time that eternally exists. Unique to the Bible is the claim that space and time are not eternal. They're finite, and they don't come into existence until God creates the universe. Now, it was here in Britain. In fact, I was reading the Bible for the first time when physicists here in Britain were developing the first of the space-time theorems. Today, we have over 30 of those space-time theorems. And I'll share with you one that's most frequently cited, published back in 2004, which states that any universe that on average expands has a beginning, including a beginning of space and time, thus implying a causal agent outside of space and time who creates this universe of matter, energy, space, and time. And only a universe that expands throughout its history permits the existence of life. So yes, it is true. Physicists have found models of the universe that don't require this causal agent, but every one of those models will not allow for the existence of life. And one of the authors of this theorem, Alexander Vilenkin, wrote this in a book shortly after this theorem got published. Himself not a believer, but he says the following, quote, "With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning." Now, the problem he is referring to is that some kind of God must exist. Now, if you read the latest books being published by atheist astronomers and physicists, they are conceding deism. Even Lawrence Krauss, in his book A Universe from Nothing, on page 173, says, because of the force of these theorems, deism is on the scientific table. In fact, the debate has shifted in the last 2 years from whether or not there's some kind of agent beyond space and time as to whether that agent is a personal being. So that's where the real debate has shifted. Now, I'm not telling you that they're saying God exists. What they're saying is there's an agent outside of space and time who created the universe and set up all the laws of physics. But last time I checked my dictionary, that is the definition of God. In fact, what was interesting, I was speaking at NASA Houston many years ago, and the director said, "This is a government institution. You're not allowed to use the word God." And I said, "Well, my whole talk is predicated on this." And he says, I said, "Well, how about this? I won't use the word God, but can I use the phrase, the agent outside of space and time who creates the universe and designs it all for the benefit of human beings?" He says, "You have my permission. You can use that." So yeah, the real debate is God personal, and did he design the universe and the earth for the sake of us human beings? Well, as much as the Bible says about the beginning of the universe, it actually says more about the expansion of the universe. Now, that's often missed on English readers of the Bible because they typically translate the Hebrew verb nata as the stretching. So you'll see phrases talking about the stretching out of the heavens and how God stretches out the heavens. But the Hebrew verb there is the verb nata, and you can check your lexicon. It means the expansion of what's being described. And it was a theologian who several years ago came to me and pointed out to me that if you look at these 11 texts, the verb nata shows up in all three biblical Hebrew verb forms, which means these are not figures of speech. They literally are speaking about the continual expansion of the universe. And it's not just me speaking from a 21st century perspective. Jewish theologians living many centuries ago read these texts and said, these texts are claiming that the universe expands throughout its history. Now, this is significant because no book in science, theology, or philosophy wrote about the expansion of the universe outside of the Bible until the 20th century. So for thousands of years, the Bible stood alone in making this claim that we live in a universe that expands from a space-time beginning. Now, the book I was recommending earlier, where you can get the free chapter, The Creator and the Cosmos, much of that book is devoted to giving you the most rigorous proof that we indeed live in an expanding universe. I don't have time to get into those most rigorous proofs. I'll give you one that is easy to understand and visual. And it's because of the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope's been giving us images of galaxies at all different distances, which means all different look-back times. So here's two examples. On the left, you see an image of galaxies located 12 billion light years away, which means we're seeing them as they were 12 billion years ago. And notice there the galaxies are jammed so tightly together that they're tearing spiral arms off one another. Contrasted with the image on the right, where we're looking at galaxies 2 billion light years away. So there's 10 billion years between the image on the right and the image on the left. And I purposely put both images to the same spatial scale so you can see how in 10 billion years the galaxies have stretched apart from one another. And now this phenomena of ripping spiral arms off one another is quite rare. And if I had time, I could show you dozens of other images that I think would demonstrate for you, indeed, the universe continuously expands throughout its history. The third point that the Bible repeatedly addresses is that we live in a universe where the laws of physics do not change. Here's one example from Jeremiah 33:25. God speaks, and he says, I've established the fixed laws of heaven and earth. And if you read the whole chapter, God is basically addressing Jews who change their mind all the time. And he says, I'm not a God like you that changes. I'm a God that's immutable. I never change. As proof that I never change, look at the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change. Then we have in Romans 8 the statement that the entire universe is subject to its bondage to decay. So a theme that's repeated in the book of Ecclesiastes, basically saying no matter where you go in the universe, you see this pervasive law of decay. In an audience like this, I just simply say, hey, look at one another to see this pervasive evidence of decay. Even little children, we can look carefully at their faces with a microscope and you can see developing liver spots. From the time we're born, we're subject to this pervasive law of decay. Now, seeing all this in the Bible at age 17, I realized this is Big Bang cosmology. The Big Bang model wasn't produced by scientists until 1925, but the Bible had been preaching it for 2,600 years. Say, so where do you get that? Okay, most of you probably got here with an automobile, and the principle of the automobile engine is based on this expansion. The piston, when the piston chamber expands, the temperature in the chamber drops, and the gasoline stops burning. The piston chamber compresses, and it now gets hot enough that it ignites the gasoline. That principle applies to everything in the universe. So as the universe expands under laws of thermodynamics, it gets cooler and cooler as it gets older and older and bigger and bigger. And so what I noted at age 17, the Bible actually predicts a cosmic cooling curve. It predicts that the universe will get cooler and cooler as it gets older and older in a highly predictable way. And if we know the age of the universe, and we've got several methods for measuring the age of the universe, and they all agree that it's 13.8 billion years old, knowing that, we get a biblically predicted cooling curve, and here's what the curve looks like, that solid line, but overlapping it are 15 measurements we astronomers have made of the past temperature of the universe. And the one you see there in the middle, that's the most accurate of the measurements made, and it's so accurate that it shows us that the temperature of the universe matches that biblically predicted line to an accuracy less than the width of the line. And so we see that indeed what the Bible predicted thousands of years ago about the character of the universe has now been demonstrated to be correct by actual measurements of the universe. And today we know what the primary factor is that drives this expansion of the universe. Gravity works to slow it down. Dark energy works to speed it up. How many of you have ever heard of dark energy before? Okay, more than half of you have heard of dark energy. It wasn't discovered until 1998 and 1999. We now know that this dark energy makes up about 70 to 71% of all the stuff of the universe. Isn't it interesting that the dominant component of the universe wasn't discovered until 1998? Now, what dark energy is, it's energy embedded in the space surface of the universe. And the way it works is that space surface gets bigger and bigger as the universe expands. That dark energy becomes progressively more powerful in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. We also know it must be fine-tuned. In fact, we have to fine-tune both the cosmic mass density and dark energy density in order to get the universe to expand at the just right rates at just right times throughout the history of the universe in order to get the galaxies, stars, and planets that are necessary for life. And we've been able to calculate the degree to which it must be fine-tuned. It must be fine-tuned to within about one part in 10 to the 122nd power. That's 122 zeros after the one. And people have said, okay, can you help me visualize that fine-tuning? I think I can. We can compare it to the best example of fine-tuning engineering design that we human beings have ever achieved. And most physicists would agree with me that the best example of that is LIGO, the gravity wave telescope that's now located in Louisiana, the state of Washington, and in Pisa, Italy. This amazing machine was the first to discover gravity waves. This machine is so well designed, it's able to make measurements to within one-tenth the diameter of a proton over a length scale of 4 kilometers. That's how amazing this machine is. It was invented by Caltech and MIT physicists several years ago, designed by them, and then funded by the U.S. government. But what I want you to notice is the level of fine-tuning design and the very best example of our human achievement ranks 10 to the 97 times inferior to the level of design in just this one feature of the universe in order to make your existence here tonight possible. What does that tell us? It tells us that the one that designed dark energy and the cosmic mass density for our benefit, at a minimum, is 10 trillion trillion, trillion trillion, trillion trillion, trillion trillion times more intelligent and more knowledgeable than those Caltech and MIT physicists. Now, I've worked with these people. They're not dumb. They rank as some of the most brilliant human beings on the planet, but they pale in comparison to the intelligence and the knowledge of the one that designed this dark energy. Or I could put it another way. The one that designed this dark energy, at a minimum, is 10 to the 97 times better funded than the U.S. government that actually made this instrument possible. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. We're not just talking about an agent that transcends space and time, because only a personal being can manifest the attributes of intellect, knowledge, creativity, and power. And so this takes the debate to the next level. Thanks to this fine-tuning evidence, we know we're dealing with a personal being. But we know we're dealing with a personal being who's got powers far, far beyond what we human beings are capable of. Now, this was not just recognized by astronomers like myself who are believers in Jesus Christ. There are many atheists who've drawn the same conclusion. Matter of fact, there were three American theoretical astrophysicists who wrote a research paper, got it published, and it caught the attention of Philip Ball, the physics editor of the British science journal Nature. And so he contacted them and interviewed them. And the interview has been published in Nature News. It's still up on the web. You can read it for yourself. But what I'm going to do is pull two quotes from that interview of these three theoretical physicists. Quote number one, "Arranging the cosmos as we think it is arranged," said the team, "would have required a miracle." Now, that's a remarkable statement for three theoretical atheist physicists to make, that there's this miracle here. And they're basically saying, if dark energy is real, then we got this miracle. Here's the second statement. "An unknown agent, namely beyond space and time, intervened in the evolution, that is the history of the universe, for reasons of its own," which explains the title of their paper. The title of their paper was "Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant," which is another term for dark energy. And the reason they chose that title is, if dark energy is real, then we're stuck with this very disturbing conclusion that an agent beyond space and time performed miracles for reasons of his own, which explains the last sentence in the research paper. This is the final sentence in their paper. "Perhaps the only reasonable conclusion is that we do not live in a world that is a universe with a true cosmological constant." They concluded their paper by saying dark energy can't be real, because if it's real, there's this agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own. Now, the irony of this paper is it was published just months before, 9 months before, we astronomers came up with 9 independent observational demonstrations that not only is dark energy real, it's the dominant component of the universe. And I've written an article on each one of these 9 discoveries. Don't get worried. The articles are only 1 page long, and they're designed to be accessible for lay people. But this is kind of the titles of these 9 discoveries that establish that dark energy is real and the dominant component of the universe. And that URL at the bottom will take you to a site where you'll not only find articles we've written on 9 of these demonstrations, because today we have 25 astronomical observational demonstrations that dark energy is real and the dominant component of the universe. Now, if you were to ask me as a scientist, where do we find the most spectacular evidence that's measurable for fine-tuning design, this would be it. But it's by no means the only one. Matter of fact, there's over 100 different features of the universe and the laws of physics that likewise show this extreme level of fine-tuning design. Here are a few examples, namely that the forces of physics all have to be fine-tuned. So, for example, if you don't have the force of electromagnetism tuned relative to the force of gravity to better than 1 part in 10,000 trillion trillion trillion, stars will either never form, or they'll form and instantly explode, or you're going to wind up with stars that will not permit the existence of life. And the list goes on. And again, you can go to a special URL, reasons.org/fine-tuning, where you'll see a list of 140 of these different features and citations to the scientific literature where this has been published. And I say, what does the C stand for? Carbon-based life. I put that in there because several years ago I debated the atheist particle physicist Victor Stenger at Caltech at the Skeptic Society conference, and he said, well, if you got different laws of physics, wouldn't you have different fine-tuning? And I said, you must be talking about angels. Yes, they live with different laws of physics and different dimensions, but guess what? Their realm is fine-tuned just like our realm is fine-tuned. But yeah, given the laws of physics, if you want life, it must be carbon-based. We can't make life on any other element. And that's the only assumption I bring into the fine-tuning, that if you want life, it must be carbon-based. Only carbon allows you to have the bonding complexity and the bonding stability to make life possible. But beginning in 1991, our scientific team at Reasons to Believe decided to put this to the test. Why? Because it tells us in Psalms and in Job that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we'll see for the supernatural handiwork of God. So beginning in 1991, our team surveyed the scientific literature. looking for those features that show this exceptional degree of fine-tuning design. And every 2 years, we'll go back and repeat that exercise. And this is what came out of that exercise. In 1991, we found 17 features of the universe that show this exceptional degree of fine-tuning design. And with every year that progressed, the list got longer and longer, demonstrating that biblical principle. The more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we see for the supernatural handiwork of God. Or if you want to see a one-sentence summary of this, how about Hebrews 1:10? The heavens are the work of your hands. Now, in my office, you'll find about 50 books that I own on what's called the anthropic principle. And this is something that all astronomers agree is correct. And we look at the universe, we see overwhelming evidence, in the words of Paul Davies, for design for the benefit of life and as human beings in particular. But as you look at those 50 books, almost all of them written by non-Christians, they stop at the level of the universe, which explains why so many of these scientists are comfortable with the universe being fine-tuned design, because if it's the universe, that's far away. But we've done it, reasons to believe, is take it to the next step. Okay, the universe as a whole is fine-tuned. What about our cluster of galaxies? What about our galaxy? What about our star? What about our planetary system? And what we discovered is, not only do we need the universe to be fine-tuned, our galaxy cluster must be fine-tuned. Now, there's tens of thousands of clusters of galaxies in the universe, but ours is the only one that has the characteristics that are necessary for light to be possible within that cluster of galaxies. And likewise, 200 different features of our Milky Way galaxy must be fine-tuned in order to make advanced life possible. How many have ever seen any one of the Star Wars movies? Okay, gee, not many of you? I mean, everybody in America has seen them. Oh, there's a few more hands coming up now. Well, I've watched the early ones. In fact, I think the early ones are way better than the later ones, but that's a matter of opinion. But you know how each one begins? A galaxy far, far away. Well, we astronomers have looked at galaxies far, far away. We don't find any better candidates. So I'm basically trying to encourage the Star Wars scriptwriters, we need to take it back to the Milky Way galaxy. There is no galaxy far, far away. And we need a just right star. And my colleagues have been looking for a sufficient twin of the sun that it could be a candidate for advanced life. That search has been going on for 60 years. We found many stars that are twins of one another, but we have yet to find a twin of the sun. I don't know if you've heard about the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. A lot of my friends are involved in that search, but I keep telling them, until you've got a star that's a candidate, you're wasting time and money looking for signals from a planet orbiting such a star. We've yet to find such a candidate star other than the sun. And now we have found about 3,800 planets outside of our solar system. The first of these planets was discovered in 1995. And I remember the excitement at the time in the astronomical community. Wow, we're going to find all kinds of planets just like the planets in our solar system. We're going to find all kinds of planets just like Earth. Well, 23 years later, we have 3,800 planets that have been discovered outside the solar system. Not only have we not found any twins of the Earth, we haven't found any twins of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus. In fact, we haven't found a single twin of any one of the planets in our planetary system. And this led to an amazing discovery by my colleagues, namely that every planet in our solar system plays a critical role in making possible advanced life here on planet Earth. I don't know whether you celebrate Thanksgiving here in Britain. That's a big deal in Canada, and the United States don't do it here. Well, we have a special day where we thank God for all the blessings that he's provided for us. We eat a whole lot of food on that day. But in our family, we thank God before we eat our turkey dinner for Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus. We go down the whole list because, as you'll see in my book, Improbable Planet, every planet plays a role in making it possible for us to be able to enjoy a dinner across the table from one another. And of course, we need a just right Earth. Over 400 different features of the Earth must be fine-tuned. And notice, we're orbiting, we're on the one planet that has a big moon. What's unique about our moon is how big it is compared to its host planet. And because of that, we have a stable rotation axis tilt. The other planets do this, we have a nice stable tilt. That's just one of 20 different features of our moon that must be fine-tuned in order to make possible advanced life here on planet Earth. And we did the same thing with the galaxy, the star, and the planetary system that we did with the universe. Our scientific team, beginning in 1995, began to survey the scientific literature. And back then, we found 41 different features of our galaxy and planetary system that must be fine-tuned to make bacterial life possible. We're not talking human life, just to get bacteria on a planet for a significant period of time. And as we continue to go back over the scientific literature year by year, you can see how the evidence has grown. That last column basically is giving you the probability of finding a life-supportable body anywhere within the entire universe that would have the capacity to support bacteria independent of a God beyond the universe supernaturally intervening to set up those features. So back in 1995, that probability was less than one chance in 10 to the 31st power. And in 2006, less than one chance in 10 to the 556th power. By the way, we've been continuing to accumulate that database, but now the database is so enormous, we've not been able to update that catalog. I got a whole bunch of astronomers volunteering to work on bringing out that update. As soon as it's ready, we'll publish it. But I can tell you the probability is way, way more remote than less than one chance in 10 to the 556th power. But if you look at that last column, what you notice is the evidence for the supernatural God of the Bible designing our galaxy and planetary system for the benefit of bacterial life gets approximately or a minimum of a factor of 1,000 times stronger per month. The average is actually about 100,000 times stronger per month, which gives me the opportunity when I speak on university campuses to say to the skeptics, if you're not persuaded today, wait 1 month and see what happens when new papers are published and how that evidence grows with respect to time. And of course, the evidence is much more compelling when we talk about animals and plants and humans. In fact, if you go to that URL, reasons.org/fine-tuning, we break down this fine-tuning evidence for 6 different categories of life. But what you notice for humans, just based on that limited database, less than one chance in 10 to the 1,050th power. Now, in North America, we have these lotteries where millions of people buy tickets and they try to win a jackpot of something like $100 million. Do they have anything like that here? They do. Okay. Well, that allows me to kind of put this in perspective. The probability of an American winning one of these gigantic lotteries, if they buy just one ticket, okay, this probability of less than one chance in 10 to the 1,050th, it's equivalent to an American buying one lottery ticket each time, but winning this grand $100 million lottery 150 consecutive times. Or as one mathematician friend of mine put it, that probability is no different than someone winning that lottery 150 consecutive times where they don't buy any tickets at all. It really is indistinguishable. And again, it's not just those of us who are Christians who are drawing these conclusions. Here's a quote, for example, from the physicist Freeman Dyson, who wrote in his book, "The more I examine the universe, the more evidence I find that the universe in some sense must have known we were coming." And this is something all my peers would agree with. Because we look at the universe, we're looking at the universe of the past, and we see as how the universe throughout its history was being progressively fine-tuned, designed to make possible the entry of us human beings. It was designed in advance for us human beings. And again, you can check it out by getting this book, The Creator and the Cosmos, or a free chapter at reasons.org/cc, We got a few copies out at the back that you're welcome to purchase at a discount. And also this book, Improbable Planet. And what that book does is actually take the fine-tuning argument one step farther. Namely, what does it take in terms of fine-tuning design, not only to have a home for human beings, but a home where billions of us can be redeemed from our propensity to commit sin and evil and come into an eternal, loving relationship with the Creator. What the Improbable Planet documents is that the fine-tuning evidence exponentially skyrockets in that context. But that's the real reason why God designed the universe the way he did. He designed it to make possible the complete elimination of evil and suffering, while at the same time enhancing our free will capability to enter into relationships with one another that are loving and completely free of sin and evil for the rest of eternity. That's the amazing thing about the laws of physics. That's the amazing thing about the experience God is taking us through right now. And we don't have this here, but this is that debate that I did with Victor Stenger in front of 700 educated atheists at Caltech. You can get it from the Skeptic Society for the equivalent of $30. We sell it for $5 because we want you to see it. And it's amazing. They give Victor Stenger the last word. You won't believe how he ends that debate. But let me end with a couple of scripture passages. Psalm 104, verse 24. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. God takes personal credit for every life form that exists on planet Earth. As we've written in several of our other books, you'll see this in Improbable Planet. It's not evolution. It's God directly intervening at just the right times and just the right places to ensure that we humans have all biological resources and the biodeposit resources to launch civilization and develop the technology where we can take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. Or we see in Isaiah 45:18, he did not create it, referring to the earth to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. And one of the wonders of the planet in which we live, no matter where you go, whether you go to Antarctica, the high mountains or the deserts, you find life. God has filled this planet with life, and I'm amazed that he designed the planet so that billions of us humans can live here at one time. And actually, God is in the business of redeeming billions of us quickly, not slowly, thanks to the care in which he's designed the universe for our specific benefit. With that, I'm going to devote the rest of the time to questions and discussion. How did the U.S. government get away with banning ID in the light of these facts? Okay, ID refers to intelligent design, and the intelligent design movement is about 20 years old. Reasons to Believe is 33 years old. We've been doing intelligent design long before there was an intelligent design movement. But the reason why there's a strong political reaction against intelligent design is they're trying to do intelligent design outside of a model. And part of it is because a lot of the participants in the intelligent design movement have not been practicing scientists, or at least engaging in scientific research at a high academic level. And when you do that, you discover science is always done in the context of a model that's testable, falsifiable, and makes predictions of future scientific discoveries. So when we launched Reasons to Believe 33 years ago, we built it on a testable creation model. And so we show how it can be falsified. We make predictions based on our model. You heard several of the predictions that I discussed tonight. And as those predictions are shown to be true, that allows us to have credibility with the scientific community. But the other reason why the intelligent design movement is not taken seriously in the United States, they don't identify the intelligent designer. If you don't identify the intelligent designer, it makes it really impossible to develop a detailed model. And without a detailed model, you're not going to get a place at the scientific table. Moreover, they take no position on the age of the Earth or the universe. And that's something every scientist is quite sensitive to. And so I think that explains why they get the reaction they do, why you get phrases like intelligent design as nothing but young Earth creationism in a cheap tuxedo. That's one of their favorite comments. So, but I can tell you this, we're having great success engaging our peers. In fact, it was a couple of years ago Unbelievable, the radio show that Justin Brierley hosts here in Britain, he had me and Paul Davies on together. And Paul said, well, creationism is nothing but, young earth creationism and intelligent design is just a cheap tuxedo. And I said, now, wait a minute, Paul. What we have at Reasons to Believe is a testable model that's falsifiable, that makes predictions. He says, give me some examples. I did. And he said, you have a place at the scientific table. What actually is dark energy? Okay, dark energy is still a mystery. In fact, every week I do a blog post on new scientific discoveries and how they tie into the Christian faith. There's one coming up where I talk about dark energy and the latest advances. In fact, it just got published in monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, the latest advances in trying to discover the nature of dark energy. Most of the evidence tells us that it's some kind of constant that pervades the entirety of the universe. When we look at the most distant objects of the universe, it doesn't look like it's a constant. And so that's kind of where the mystery is coming in. We do know how it behaves. It pervades all of the space surface of the universe, and it behaves in such a way that it accelerates the expansion of the universe. But exactly what kinds of constants or set of constants are governing this dark energy, that's still something we astronomers are trying to figure out. That's one of the holy grails of modern astronomy. So yeah, if you invite me back in 2 or 3 years, I might be able to give you an answer to your question. Here we go. Please explain the theory of parallel universes and how this fits with the Bible. Well, this is the idea that there's not just one universe, but many universes, and some astronomers have hypothesized maybe even there's an infinite number of universes. And some have hypothesized that maybe all these universes are different from all the other universes. And if it's really an infinity, that means every possibility can happen. That's how they're attempting to explain away the fine-tuning evidence. They say if there's an infinite number of universes and each one's different from all the others, then one of those universes, by pure chance, will have all the characteristics we need for life to possibly exist in the universe. So God didn't design the universe, the multiverse did. But it was the atheist physicist Leonard Susskind who said, we atheists have got to stop using that argument. It's not a good argument. Namely, what he was pointing out is a theory that explains everything explains nothing. And he stopped at that. But I took up his statement and developed kind of an analogy, and it's actually published in the book out there, The Creator and the Cosmos, where I said, if you've got an infinite number of universes, well, they're all different from the others, you'll actually have an infinite number of universes that'll have planets just like Earth with birch trees growing on them. And you'll have an infinite variety of species of birch trees. And one of those species will peel white sheets of bark. All birch trees peel white sheets of bark, right? But this is a species that peels white sheets that are the size of A4 paper. And they fall on the ground. And this happens to be a planet where there's chemicals in the soil of the ground that make random markings on the bits and pieces of paper. And with an infinite number of universes, you're going to wind up with bits and pieces of that birch bark that are going to have all the markings that you see in every research paper published by every research scientist in the world. And so all those equations you see and all those paragraphs you see and the photographs and diagrams you see in all those technical papers, they didn't come from the minds of scientists. The multiverse did it. So you're basically pointing out as being philosophically inconsistent. But here's a positive spin you can put on it. If the atheist version of the multiverse is correct, then eventually we're going to see, if it's just pure chance that we have all these design features, that design evidence at some point will begin to decline. But if it really is the God of the Bible, as we continue to learn more, we're going to see the design evidence continuing to accumulate. Well, we've been doing this research now for 65 years. Notice the trend line. It's been going up, and it's been going up exponentially. It has never gone down. Therefore, that's a strike against the atheist version of the multiverse and a vote in favor of the Christian model. And I find this amusing. You go back into the medieval era, you had Christian theologians saying nothing less than an infinite universe would befit an infinite creator. And so these atheists have actually borrowed a concept from the Christian community and tried to apply it to escape the fine-tuning argument. But yeah, if there really is an infinite number of universes where anything can happen because they all have different varieties, that means there's a universe in which you have no debt. Okay, find that universe. Okay. Yeah, I'm not quite catching how God can use quantum mechanics. Yeah, there's a number of theistic physicists who speculate. Roger Penrose is probably the best example of that, where he says maybe the fine-tuning design is hidden in the quantum entities. And he's written two books on that where he speculates about that, but he's now in the position that just doesn't work. You can't hide enough fine-tuning under the Heisenberg uncertainty to explain all the fine-tuning we see today. And it actually led to a discovery that his colleague, George Ellis, was able to develop. Interesting story. George Ellis, the South African astrophysicist, there was a big meeting of astrophysicists from around the world, but right next door was another international meeting for nutritionists, and he walked into the wrong lecture hall. So here he was sitting in on this lecture on nutrition, but when he was listening to it, he says, I've got to stay here. And he wound up writing a research paper on it, making the point that there are proteins in our body and the bodies of all living life forms that critically depend on the Heisenberg uncertainty, because there's a whole bunch of proteins in your body that are just like transistors. And what he was able to demonstrate is, okay, quantum mechanics says that if you measure the momentum of a particle to high precision, you'll be uncertain about its position to about plus or minus half a mile. But we discovered that this nutrition conference, if you make it bigger than the plus or minus a half mile or less than a plus or minus a half mile, those proteins will fail to work and all life dies. So even the uncertainty we have in the universe is fine-tuned. And you may have remembered that famous debate between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein. Does God play dice? Well, the answer to that is God indeed does play dice, but he very carefully designs the dice to get exactly the outcome he wants. And of course, from God's perspective, he's not limited by space and time. There's no uncertainty for him. It's certainly an uncertainty for us. What is the purpose of antimatter? Good question. And probably the best answer to that is a book published a few years ago called The Left Hand of Creation, making the point that the universe is not perfectly symmetrical. It's very slightly asymmetrical. And he writes in that book how the universe began with equal quantities of matter and antimatter. And then very early in the history of the universe, younger than a billionth of a second, we have an annihilation event where the matter and antimatter merge and form energy. But what he points out, there's about 100 billion and one particles for every 100 billion antiparticles, which means a little bit of matter was left over. So the universe literally had 200 billion times as much matter as it has today. But an annihilation event reduced it down to the matter we have in the universe today. And that amount of matter is fine-tuned to make possible the existence of life. If you got more matter than that, then you're going to wind up with all the elements being heavier than iron. If you got less, you wind up with only hydrogen and helium. Either way, you're missing the carbon, the oxygen, and the nitrogen that's necessary for life. And they realized it was the separation of the forces of physics in the early history of the universe that led to that very tiny imbalance. Yeah, in the beginning, there was nearly equal amounts of matter and antimatter, very slightly more matter than there was antimatter. You say, how do you explain the antimatter that exists today? Well, there's nuclear particle physics reactions that will change some of the matter into antimatter. So there is a tiny amount of antimatter in the universe, but it's predominantly matter. And yeah, when antimatter comes into contact with matter, you get an annihilation event and energy. Is not the most parsimonious explanation for the existence of the universe that it just is, rather than that God made it and that God just is? Thanks. Well, Wednesday morning, I did a televised debate with the chemist here in Britain, Peter Atkins. And this is one of the questions we discuss. Wouldn't it be simpler to say there's just no God? Well, the evidence is it would actually be a lot more complicated to try to make all this happen in just the right way so there'd be life without God. I argue that God is actually the simpler explanation, but actually led to another part of the debate. By the way, the debate is going to be made publicly available in about 2 or 3 weeks' time. And when it is, we're going to give you the URL on our reasons.org website so you can watch it or listen to it and just see the whole context. But the argument came down to Occam's razor. William of Ockham, made the point that we should always look for the simplest answer in science. But I argued with Peter Atkins that that's not been the history of science. The simplest answer has never been the right answer. In fact, the history of science is every time we think it's simple, we find out that it's slightly more complicated. And yeah, we should, kind of look for the simplest solution, but expect that we're not going to have the simplest solution as a correct answer. And I argued that a better principle for guiding science is that the right answer is always the most elegant and beautiful answer. Look for beauty and elegance, and that will be the pathway. I would argue that the Christian perspective on creation is the most beautiful, is the most elegant. In fact, there was a famous theologian here in Britain, Thomas Torrance, who would frequently speak to audiences of atheist physicists. And he told me this privately. He says, I had an 18-minute lecture that I would give to them, but the entire lecture was just how beautiful mathematics and physics is. And he said, I led dozens of these physicists to faith in Jesus Christ, so simply pointing out how beautiful it is and how this must betray the creative activity of a being who enjoys beauty and elegance. And I would argue, look at how beautiful this planet is. God didn't have to make it this beautiful in order for us to live here. But this planet is extravagant in its beauty and its elegance. Everywhere we look, we see beauty and elegance. And something you'll see in my book, Improbable Planet, this moment in human and Earth's history, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, but the past 9,000 years has been the most scenically beautiful moment in the entire history of the Earth. Never before in the history of Earth have we had the spectacular scenic beauty that we have today. And that's thanks to the fact that we are living after the most extreme ice age in the ice age cycle of the past 2.6 million years. That's what's responsible for all those magnificent fjords that you see in Norway, and I could go on. So yeah, look for beauty, look for elegance. Well, that's a very good question. I know you all heard the question, namely that if we find intelligent life on some other planetary system, how would that impact my Christian faith? Well, this is something that's been debated by Christians literally back 1900 years. So it's been a long-going debate. And basically, you wind up with Christians on both sides of the issue. One group of Christians says, when I read the Bible, I see a God that really enjoys creating. It's like God is almost compulsively creative. So why would he stop just on planet Earth? He must have created life on all kinds of other planets, and we should look for that life. Other theologians have argued, well, when you look at the ministry of Jesus when he was here on earth, he conserved his miracles. What I mean by that, he only performed those miracles to serve his stated purpose. So he wasn't profligate with his miracles. He performed the fewest needed to achieve his purpose. And they argue that based on God's stated purpose for creating the universe that we see in the Bible, he only needs one planet. So they're arguing that we are alone. The only passage I see in the Bible that puts any limitation on this debate is Hebrews 9 and 10, where it says the creator of the universe, Jesus Christ, died one time, one place for all, which would seem to indicate that this planet Earth is the only place in the universe where we've got intelligent spiritual beings that are in need of being redeemed from their sinful behavior. But that leaves the door open for God creating dolphins on another planet, or grass on another planet, or even beings like us that are not in need of redemption on another planet. So it's a wide open debate, and you'll see an article that we have written on our reasons.org website explaining all this. But the reason we wrote the article, if you're an atheist, you have only one option. you have to argue that the origin of life is a simple, straightforward event, and therefore there's going to be life everywhere in the universe. But what we astronomers are discovering, we've done an ardent search for life elsewhere, and everywhere we look, we see conditions that are hostile for the existence of life. So it appears from a scientific perspective that we are alone, with one important caveat. I've been on record since the 1980s. We will find the remains of life on virtually every solar system body. But simply because our planet has taken so many hits from asteroids and comets and meteoroids that a lot of Earth's soil has been exported throughout the solar system. And in that soil will be the microbes of Earth's life. Matter of fact, three of my colleagues have published a paper where they've calculated 20,000 kilograms of Earth's soil exists on every 100 square kilometers of the moon's surface. And most of that soil arrived through low-velocity collision events. So they're arguing if we want to find the fossils of Earth's first life, we need to go to the moon. We won't find them on the Earth because Earth's geology has destroyed them. But the moon has virtually no geological activity. We can go to the moon, find the fossils of Earth's first life, and figure out who got the model right, the atheists or the theists. In fact, I spoke on that at NASA Houston a few years ago and said, this is something you really need to think seriously about. Because the last time I checked, 100% of the U.S. taxpayer base was made up of theists and non-theists, and they'd all be excited about seeing who got it right. Well, I think we've only got two copies of The Improbable Planet left outside. That book deals with that question in detail. Basically, we make the point we got very strong evidence that life has been here for 3.825 billion years. We got a very accurate data on the origin of life, and we know that life has become progressively more complex with respect to time. So we accept that definition of biological evolution. But the really big question philosophically is, what or who is responsible for these changes over the past 3.8 billion years? And I argue that the reason why there hasn't been a lot of progress at exploring the supernatural option is that biologists have not been taking into account the physics of the sun, the earth, and the moon. So throughout the past 3.8 billion years, because our sun's been fusing hydrogen into helium, the sun's been getting progressively brighter. It's brighter today by 23% compared to the origin of life 3.8 billion years ago. And life could only tolerate a 1% change in the luminosity of the sun. But we notice when we look at the fossil record testifies to a history of life being progressively more efficient at drawing greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So as the sun gets progressively brighter and brighter, we see that we have life that progressively takes more of these greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and therefore maintains an ideal temperature for life on the surface of the Earth. And we see in the fossil record is typified by mass extinction events rapidly followed by mass speciation events. And what I mean by that is millions of species being removed from the planet and quickly millions of new species replacing them. And you actually see that in Psalm 104. It's a history of life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth. And so you'll see in that book a couple of chapters on these mass extinction and mass speciation events, basically documenting that what we have is some mind that knows the future physics of the sun and therefore removes exactly the right species of life from the planet and replaces them with the just right species to perfectly compensate for the changed physics of the sun, and it happens at exactly the frequency you would need to keep in step with the changing physics of the sun, basically arguing it's not random process. There is a mind that's behind, and that mind is supernaturally bringing species of life onto the planet to keep things ideal.
It's a contradiction between the Bible and evolution, it seems.
Well, not really. My colleagues, we have biologists that are on our research team, and they're actually in the process of writing a book, Common Design or Common Descent. And they're basically picking up on the argument by Richard Owen, who was just before Charles Darwin. And it was Richard Owen who argued that if we're talking about God being responsible for introducing these life forms, we would expect that he's going to use repeated optimized designs. And that's what we see in Earth's life. We see identical designs appearing over and over again. And actually, this was tested by an experiment at Michigan State University. It's now been running for 30 years. It's what's called the long-term evolution experiment. And basically, they're documenting what natural evolution can do and what it can't do. But the surprising result that they got is that the evolutionary outcomes are random. They're not repeated. But what we see in the history of life is thousands of examples of repeated identical outcomes. And this is actually what is persuading people. In fact, there's an evolutionary biologist here in Britain, Simon Conway Morris, who has argued that this is evidence for God's intervention, the fact that we see all these repeated designs. This is a very fertile debate that's going on. You can get some books from us. We don't have them at the table, but we have a book where it's basically a book-length debate between reasons to believe and biologos. Is it theistic evolution, or is it God actually intervening through his mind and creating just the right species? There's also a Four Views book that's come out, which is Reasons to Believe, Biologos, Answers in Genesis, the Young Earth Organization, and the Discovery Institute. And these are the issues we debate. Well, you can read the book that we published with Biologos. They're promoting the view that we human beings are the product of pure common descent. We're promoting the view that Adam and Eve are specially created and all of us human beings are descended from them. And you can actually read the scientific debate we had with them and our critique of their model and their critique of our model. That book is available. It's in our catalog. And we can talk afterwards if you like at more detail. And incidentally, you'll see quite a bit on that in the book, Who is Adam? It's a 400-page book we publish, basically making the point that if we bring the experiments in here, our main critique of our theistic evolutionary friends, and by the way, it's a friendly debate. We spent a lot of time with one another, is that they're basing their whole conclusions on theoretical genetics models and ignoring the field experiments. And so it's interesting that when you take, say, a male and a female of a mammal and put them in isolation and let them reproduce, you always get way more genetic diversity being generated than what the theoretical models predict. And therefore, we argue that their claim that we're descended from 10,000 individuals is simply an upper limit. And that upper limit keeps going down as we learn more and more. And incidentally, what's remarkable about the human species is how little genetic diversity we have. We would expect a lot more from an evolutionary perspective.
Could you just have a stab, please, at describing in sort of simple scientific terms the nature of the God that you assume is the source of the all this fine-tuning?
Okay.
What form does he take, or it take?
What form does God take in terms of bringing about this fine-tuning? Is that your question?
No. What form does the being or the entity that you're assuming is the source of all this fine-tuning? What's the nature of this entity?
Okay, I think I get the question now. And it tells us in Romans chapter 1 that the record of nature not only reveals God, but it reveals God's attributes. And the book of Job even makes the point that the record of nature gives you a basic outline of how God intends to redeem human beings who desire to have a permanent relationship with him. So it's basically making the claim the record of nature is powerful. What I showed tonight is that it must be a being that transcends space and time, because it's a being that creates space and time. And actually what you see in the Bible, that God can arbitrarily compress time or expand time. Psalm 90, a day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. A day of 1,000 years is like a day. 1,000 years is like a watch in the night. Mathematically, that tells us God at a minimum must have the capacity to move and operate in at least the equivalent of 2 independent dimensions of time. And if that's the case, then God would have no beginning, no ending, and would be uncreated. And so that gives us a concept of the transcendence. As we look at what we see in the record of nature, as I said tonight, it tells us that that agent beyond space and time must be a personal being with enormous intellect, knowledge, creativity, and power. As we look at the harmony we see amongst the life forms here on planet Earth and how they're all optimized to make life better for all other life forms, this tells us it's a God who has great care for his creatures and great love for his creatures. And as you see in the book of Job, it's a God that has written a law on the heart of every human being. And that law tells us that the creator of the universe is a moral God and is morally perfect, because what we notice about our conscience, it reacts even when we make a very slight violation of that law that's written on our heart. And it was Job who said, "When I look out at nature, I see that God is extremely powerful. I see that he is very loving. I see that he's incredibly knowledgeable. And I see I can't live up to the moral law he's placed on my heart. But that being the case, God's love tells me he's made a way of escape from what I'm not able to do for myself." And what's interesting about Job, simply looking at the record of nature, he was able to say in the 19th chapter, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him on the last day. In my flesh, I will see him." He also knew the Redeemer had to be identical to the Creator. He got all that from the record of nature. And you say, well, how come everybody doesn't get that? Well, I don't think there has ever been a human being who matches the humility of Job. And the book of Job ends by saying it takes humility to recognize these truths. And basically had Job pray for his three friends that they would gain the humility they needed to draw the same conclusions. Okay.
Yes and no. Just one point. He sounds like quite an attractive figure based on that. And yet you say he transcends all the usual laws of space-time that we exist within. So I don't quite understand, is he like us or not? You know, is he one of us or
Well, that's
not?
A good question. One that comes up in a lot of debates I have is like, okay, is your God a God who only performs miracles that are transcendent? Well, we do see transcendent miracles in the Bible. The creation of the universe transcends space and time. Jesus walking in water transcends the laws of physics. But what you notice is the Bible far more frequently speaks about transformational miracles, where God doesn't violate the laws of physics, but engineers the laws of physics in such a way we recognize it's an outright miracle. Those miracles are far more frequently described in the Bible, and basically makes the point that God is both immanent and transcendent. I mean, if you look at the religions of the world, you can classify them to two categories outside of the Bible. I mean, for example, we have in Islam that God transcends the universe, but he's not within the universe. He's not immanent. He doesn't. So in Islam, there's this view that God is distant. He's beyond us and untouchable and unreachable. And then you have religions like Hinduism and Buddhism, which has God as immanent but not transcendent, where God fills his universe. He's part of the universe. Unique to Christianity is a doctrine that God is simultaneously immanent and transcendent. He's completely free to operate independent of all physical reality. Yet at the same time, it tells us in Jeremiah, for example, that it's a God that fills the entirety of the universe. Or as David says in Psalm 139, there's nowhere I can go where God is not present and operating. And that's comforting, meaning no matter where I go, I'm never alone. God is there with me, and if I want, I can access that God at any time. He's simultaneously transcendent and immanent.